91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This afternoon, we feature longtime South Florida reporter and broadcaster Jim DeFede. He'll discuss many regional issues, including topics covered on his weekly Facing South Florida program. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Jim DeFede made his mark in South Florida with investigative newspaper work in the Miami New Times. He rattled quite a few cages over 11 years. He then moved more mainstream. The Miami Herald took him on as Metro columnist in 2002. Later, a shocking public suicide led to his firing by the paper. Now, 11 years later, Jim DeFede is a busy investigative reporter at CBS4, as well as the host of his own program. We'll talk to him in minutes after the news.
Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, it's today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. This hour we visit with one of South Florida's most prized journalists, CBS4 investigative reporter and public affairs program host, Jim DeFede.
A little chronology. He began work in our region with the Miami New Times, where he made a name for himself as a hard-hitting print reporter for some 11 years.
He then served as the sometimes controversial Miami Herald Metro columnist for 4 years, then moved to television on CBS4, where he's won 5 Emmys for his investigative work.
He hosts the weekly Facing South Florida with Jim DeFede and also works on documentaries. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you for having me. It's
been a long time.
It's been a long time, but I couldn't let the show go without trying to make one last appearance. I'm speaking on behalf of a lot of people. I know this is early to start doing this, but Joe, we're going to miss you.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's the program is ending. Bonnie will still be with the station. I'm retiring, and I've been doing this almost 18 years.
What
this,
a run.
This program. Some of our listeners might not know it, but this September is the last month of the program. We'll be starting with a new program.
Did I announce that I out you?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
All right.
No, you wouldn't do that, would you?
No.
But I appreciate those sentiments, and you've been one of my favorite guests. I remember we used to play word associations
for
a while.
Oh, it's always a fun, yeah.
Well, let's start with a word association here. Everything has changed. I had a lot to start with to talk to you about. But now with Hurricane Irma knocking at our door, I just want to say your Everglades documentary is amazing. And there's this ominous warning right at the end of the, it's called The Everglades. Let me get the actual name. The Everglades, where politics, money, and race collide. And there's this ominous warning by Republican State Senator David Simmons about what might happen if a hurricane of significant proportion were to hit Lake Okeechobee just at the very, very end and the Hoover Dyke were to be breached. Well, I mean, we don't know where this hurricane's going.
No, it's a thought that has occurred to me. You know, this is one of those times where I hope I'm not prescient, you know, in terms of seeing where things are going. The Herbert Hoover Dyke, for those who don't know, is more than a 70-year-old earthen berm that surrounds Lake Okeechobee. Lake Okeechobee is the second largest freshwater lake in the continental United States. It is a massive holding of water. If that berm were to break and rupture, the towns of Clewiston, South Bay, Pahokee, Belglade would be in dire, dire straits. Something similar happened in 1928. And at that time, 3,000 people were killed when the waters came rushing over the top of the dike and then through the dike as that. And the Army Corps of Engineers has known for at least 10 years, if not 20 years or longer, that that dike is on the verge of failure. They've been trying to do repairs. Congress has been not always there to issue the money and get it repaired, but that dike is a major problem. And yeah, whether it's a rain event or a wind event that gets those waves lapping up against that earthen berm, you know, my thoughts are definitely not only with folks here in South Florida and the Keys, but those small impoverished towns around Lake Okeechobee.
It has to be understood that Florida, with its coastal ridges, it's like a saucer where Lake Okeechobee is in the center. It's like blowing on a saucer that the water, that's what happened in 1928. That was a true earthen dike there. Today's Hoover is earthen, you say, but it's concrete reinforced. It's a much larger edifice than was there.
It is, but it's still at its core. It's still large portions are earth. You're right. They have started trying to put in concrete walling and other reinforcements to try to get it along. But at the rate of repairs right now, the dike will not be reinforced until 2025. And the Army Corps of Engineers just a few months ago once again said that dike could rupture at any moment.
Right. So it begs the question, why are they not doing anything?
It is a matter of funding and priorities and issues. Let's face it, it's the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers oversees that dike, responsible for repairs. The federal government is responsible for paying for those repairs. That means Congress. Let's be honest. Before 2005, nobody was giving a lot of priorities to repairing the nation's dike and levee and dam system.
You mean until Katrina?
Until Katrina, exactly. In 2005, when Katrina hit, it wasn't the storm. It wasn't Katrina itself that killed the people. It was the water that came in and the dikes and the levees that breached and the people that ended up drowning as a result, more than 1,000 people. And so in 2005, the Army Corps of Engineers realized they didn't want to see more dead black people floating in the water. And so they started reevaluating their entire system. And much to their chagrin, they identified 12 out of more than 700 dikes and dams around the country that were in dire need of repair. And the Lake Okeechobee Dike, Herbert Hoover Dike, was at the very top of that list.
You know, we're kind of skipping around, but at the end, you also say there's a new algae bloom that was detected. Of course, you started by investigating the sure. blue-green algae bloom that was on the Treasure Coast last year. But what could a hurricane mean for another crisis, another algae bloom crisis?
Well, let me take a step back. Okay. We started looking at this documentary because of the algae toxic algae crisis that hit the Treasure Coast of Florida in mid-2016. And we wanted to understand the roots of it. And what it really, there are many reasons for it. You know, the slow rate of Everglades restoration, which has not restored that flow of water south. The toxic pollutants that are coming in, the phosphorus and nitrogen that are just flowing into the Lake Okeechobee like a open sewer from Orlando south, all the cattle ranches, orange groves, the development, the housing, everything just flowing in along the Kissimmee River into Lake Okeechobee. You know, and then what happens is because they want to keep that dam and that dike safe, they keep the water level artificially low. And as a result, with their only options are, since they can't send the water south because Everglades restoration has been delayed, they have to blast it out east and west along the St. Lucie estuary to the east and the Coosahatchee to the west. And when they blast out that toxic water filled with phosphorus and nitrogen and all those pollutants, it's one of the most polluted of waterways that we have, the toxic algae that's in that thing just explodes. It's like pouring kerosene or gasoline on a fire. It just absolutely takes off. So now you've got a situation where we've got a major storm coming, and we've seen rains for the past few weeks continuing to increase. What does the Army Corps of Engineers do in advance of the hurricane? Well, there's a conference call this afternoon with the South Florida Water Management District and others. I'm going to be interested to see, do they try to lower the level of the lake in anticipation of it by opening up those floodgates again? Right. And could we, in order to avoid one disaster, which could possibly be the rupturing of the dikes, do we create another disaster, which is the algae blooms on the coast? This is the delicate balance that is constantly trying to be matched. And this was what we went into to try to understand better by looking at Everglades restoration, by looking at the Army Corps of Engineers, by looking at the pollution flowing in from the north, everything from septic tanks and why we still use septic tanks in Florida, you know, to all the different issues that we have. And because there's no one easy answer. That's the takeaway from the Everglades, is there's no simple answer to any of it.
And they're pushing that water out to sea.
They're pushing fresh water, which is in Lake Okeechobee.
If they open up the canals.
When they open up the St. Lucie and when they open up the floodgates east and west to St. Lucie and Coosahatchee, ultimately that water flows out into the ocean. That's clear. That's fresh water. That water should be going south to replenish the river grass and ultimately our aquifer. you know, it would be cleaned if it went south through the stormwater treatment areas. You know, what the water does is it's filled with phosphorus. But when you send it into a stormwater treatment area with cattails and mangroves, particularly cattails, what you end up with is the cattails absorb the phosphorus, clean the water, and then it can be discharged south where it can replenish the Everglades itself, and more importantly, our aquifer and our drinking water. If we lose that, if we don't have that fresh water, then we're all in trouble.
Cattails thrive in a high nutrient water.
They like it. You know, it's not
the Everglades
natural.
System is a low nutrient ecology.
It's supposed to be, you know, and as a result, so the phosphorus is the nutrient we're talking about. And that phosphorus could come from runoff from farms. That was a big problem a lot earlier. Today, the sugar farms are a lot better at doing the work, but for decades they were terrible at it, and so that you had a lot of runoff from fertilizer and the rest of it just spilling out into the Everglades. You had, and that created lots of problems. So it's a very complex ecosystem, you know, and it's one that's just fascinating. And as the title suggests, it involves politics, it involves money, and it involves race.
So what's the race end?
The race part of it is you have what you saw with this year. Or last year, there was a Senate bill that was created to try to create a reservoir south.
Senate Bill 10.
This was because the algae bloom happened in the Stewart area. Stewart is represented by the incoming Senate president that year, Joe Negron. So you had a situation where Joe Negron, the incoming Senate president, has his entire district just filled with toxic green algae that is just stinking up things, forcing beaches to close. So he takes action. Well, Big Sugar doesn't like it when you want to take land away from them south to build reservoirs. They see that as an infringement on their rights. And so you had a situation where you could do one of two things. You either build this in from the environmentalist standpoint, this was good-hearted environmentalists who are just out to do the right thing versus greedy billion-dollar sugar companies. Sugar companies wanted to portray it as this was rich environmentalists who live on the Tony Treasure Coast of Florida with their fancy boats and their waterfront homes against the poor communities that live around the lake that derive their income from farming.
Clewiston. Belgrade.
Pahokee. South Bay. That are Pahokee, South Bay, and Belgrade are three of the four poorest cities in the state of Florida. Their poverty rate is at around 30%. Their unemployment rate is high. Their crime rate is high. And so you have a situation where you have these African-American communities, largely African-American communities, that are going to be decimated if land is taken away, mills are closed, sugar refinery is cut down. Their already high unemployment is just going to skyrocket.
It's such a complex issue, and what's so good about the documentary is you do present all sides of it, and it's just good for anybody who doesn't know exactly what the situation is.
You can see it online.
You can see
it. Let me give it just a plug. It's go to cbsmiami.com/Everglades. cbsmiami.com/Everglades. Very simple. We interviewed Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, Bob Graham,
Carl Hyacinth,
Charlie Crist. I mean, we had access inside Florida Crystals, one of the largest sugar manufacturers in the world, if not the largest manufacturer in the world. We talked to representatives from U.S. Sugar. We talked to environmentalists, townspeople. We spent a year doing some 40, 50 interviews to try to give a perspective. And we try to break it down as simply as possible so that someone who is not familiar with the subject matter could watch it for the first time and actually get an understanding of it. And I'm very proud that CBS Miami, CBS 4 News, gave me the time to do it and then aired it without commercial interruption.
And it's 58 minutes, and it really does give you a whole history of the area and really explains exactly what the problems are there. CBS4 investigative reporter and public affairs program host facing South Florida, Jim DeFede. We'll be right back.
We're back. It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, And Jim Defeedy of CBS4 is our guest. Jim, we were talking about some journalism principles during the break, and I want to get back to that. But
there are actually journalism principles, I believe that. But we'll get back to that later.
But we'll get back to that. But before we do, with Irma possibly on our doorstep, you've been here a long time. Do you feel that our state and local emergency management teams are in good shape for this?
I actually think we have really good infrastructure here in terms of Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, Broward Sheriff's and Broward Fire. I think that the Monroe County, I think these folks understand, the folks who are there, many of them have been around for a long time. They're not Johnny come latelys. It's not a surprise or it's not a coincidence that prior to this current FEMA manager, the last two FEMA directors came out of Florida. Craig Fugate was the FEMA director during the Barack Obama administration. He was a Florida guy. And before that, David Paulison was the FEMA director post-Katrina for George W. Bush. He was Miami-Dade Fire Rescue.
You had him on a couple of weeks.
We had him on. Yeah. And I mean, this notion of Florida understands this, I think is real. The question I don't worry about, are the folks in power smart enough to know it? I'm just worried, are the people prepared for it, because we have such short memories? So many new people. That was my point. I was going to say, how many people who are new to Florida? I was here for Hurricane Andrew. Hurricane Andrew came within 6 months of my arriving in Florida. You know, so it's still a vivid memory for me. But even now, today, I'm still thinking, well, it's probably going to turn, or it's probably going to move this way. I'm probably not going to close my shutters until Thursday. Why rush to do anything? You know, you become a little blasé about it. And that can be problematic. So I think that I worry not about the officials as much as I worry about the people taking it seriously.
I drove by Costco this morning at a little after 7, and they had big lines at the gas pumps already.
We're out of water in most stores in South Florida now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to change the subject from Irma and the Everglades to you.
Sure.
As a 10-year-old, I want to hear this. I want to know when you got this hankering to be a journalist and what...
Here's the story of like, if I were to put myself on a couch and do the psychiatrist thing, where, especially my wanting to do journalism and covering politics. So I don't know. This is a confession I'm going to make here. My first very, 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 very first job was I worked for the Nixon reelection campaign in 1972.
Oh,
I was 10 years old and I was living in Brooklyn, New York, and in Bay Ridge. On Sundays, very Catholic, you know, Italian sort of neighborhood, and potential good votes for Nixon.
Was that against Eugene McCarthy in 70? No. Yes. No.
Well, you're ahead of me. But 72, all I knew was that some guy came to me and said, gave me $10 and gave me 1,000 flyers and said, distribute these on the car parking windshields in all the church parking lots up and down, you know, in Bay Ridge. And then when you get done with those, come back. I'll give you another $10 with another 1,000. And I thought this was the easiest money I ever made. And I went up and down just putting Nixon flyers in all the windshields in all the parked cars. And it was paid to me in cash. And I realized you shouldn't pay workers in cash. I like to think of it somehow that money got from like the Watergate, from the Liddy, from that safe that everyone read about in Watergate. Somehow that money trickled down to me getting a tenner, a 10 spot, you know, to do that. So, all right. So that's my early admission. I was a hack for the Nixon reelection committee. But so when Watergate came around, my father and family were all Republicans, and my dad was a big Nixon supporter and didn't believe any of the news reporting that was going on about Richard Nixon. And I remember the summer of the Watergate hearings.
Although Richard Nixon doesn't look so bad in 2017.
It's all relative, I guess. You know, during the Watergate hearings that summer, I was going to camp at St. Anselm's, and my father would pick me up from camp every day and drive me home. It was like drop him off in the morning, pick you up in the afternoon, take you home, and you did things in between. But so as I would drive home with my father in the afternoon, he would have the Watergate hearings on the radio. He was absolutely riveted by listening to every single minute. And I would get in the car and I would, you know, and he would tell me, listen to this, listen to this. And he would explain to me who this person was and who that person was, and whether I really understood it, I don't know. But I just he was fascinated. He was just caught up in it. And you could tell that he was devastated by it. And when Nixon resigned, and before that, you know, my father came to the conclusion that Nixon was guilty. I remember vividly sitting in the kitchen of my apartment with my father, and he just lecturing me at all of, I guess it would have been 12 at that time, that I have to do better, that he was fooled, that Nixon had betrayed him, that he had thought he understood what a good man was, and clearly he was wrong. And he never voted in an election after that. He made it clear to me that he could not be trusted to vote because he had been hoodwinked by Nixon. And he just kept telling me, you have to do better. You have to do better. Now, it doesn't take a real shrink to understand my cynicism for politicians that then slowly developed. So I initially go to college as an engineering major at Colorado State University. I was going to be a civil engineering major. Didn't really like that. For some reason, I didn't realize engineers need to do math. Apparently, that's a concept I was unfamiliar with.
It would have been strange for you to arrive in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Yeah. Fort Collins, Colorado. I flew from Brooklyn to Denver, got out, went to a cab and said, because I'd never been to Colorado before, and I just said, I need to go to Fort Collins.
It's about 80 miles.
Yeah, the guy was like, no, you need to take a shuttle bus or something. You don't have enough money to get a cab to Fort Collins. And
well, continue your story.
But no, but my point is, so I was an engineering major until they kicked me out of the engineering college. And then, because I was, I partied a lot my freshman year, and I was drinking heavily and having a good time like college kids do. And when I finally got kicked out of the engineering program, I met with my counselor, and he said you need to try something different. So I said okay, and they said we think the arts, humanities, and social science college is probably more your speed. So I was like, okay, is there a major you like? And I went, well, political science sounds fun, poli sci. And he said, oh, that's good. Drinking there isn't a problem. You can so I became a poli sci major, and that's it. I became a poli sci major. I never did graduate from college. My father passed away my second year in school, and that sobered me up, and I realized I couldn't not take school seriously. So my second year, after my father died, I buckled down, became a good student, studied well, went to courses, got good grades, and was never more bored in my entire life. My third year, I ran for student council. I also volunteered at the crisis hotline. I was a big believer in that Winston Churchill phrase, don't let classes stand in the way of your education. So I participated in everything other than the classes. My fourth year, I was student body president. I led statewide strikes. I was appointed by the governor, Richard Lamb at the time, to be on the university governing board system. And while I was sitting on the university governing board system, Colorado does not have good sunshine laws. Florida has good sunshine laws, Colorado not as much. So there were a lot of meetings of the governing board. I was the student representative for the state system, were done behind closed doors. And I would get really frustrated and angry at what I was hearing behind closed doors, and then they would say something else in public. And, you know, like dumb things. Like I was fighting against, you know, raising student fees and, you know, tuition increases. At the same time, I was seeing certain professors, them paying out $1 million settlements to students who have been sexually harassed, you know, and then covering it up and things like that. And so it just seemed outrageous to me. And I would rail against it and give my little speeches and try to lead protests. Like I said, I led a statewide student strike while I was at Colorado State. And none of that, you know, I realized had much impact. And then at the end of my fourth year, I didn't want to run for student body president again. And so the editor of the school newspaper came to me and said, why don't you come and work for me? And I said, I'd never taken a journalism class a day in my life. And he said, you don't need to take a journalism class. Nobody knows where the bodies are buried better than you. Nobody understands the inner workings of the university better than you. Why don't you come work for me? And they said, it pays? He says, yes, it pays. So I said, great. So on my last day as student body president, I packed up all the confidential files that I had been given as a representative to the governing board and moved from my student body president office on the main floor of the student union down to the basement where the student newspaper was and just started writing exposés about the things that I knew about. And what I realized was I could rant about them at a meeting and everyone would go, oh, such a good student. Oh, look at you. You're adorable raising these issues. But then when I wrote about it in the school newspaper, the most amazing thing happened is that the paper in the city, the guy who was covering the university for the Coloradoan in Fort Collins, which is a USA Today Gannett paper, you know, he would see my stories. And then he would start asking questions about it, and then he would write about it. And once he wrote about it, then it got on the AP, and suddenly it went statewide. And so while I didn't get credit, I started realizing that if I start writing, the power of the pen, start writing these stories, then suddenly people take notice, and change would occur, and people would start holding hearings and the rest of it. And that's it. It bit. I dropped out of school after 5 years, got a job in Spokane, Washington, and just stayed with journalism.
And what brought you to the Miami New Times?
I was working in Spokane for 5.5 years, looking for a change. I started off as a night cops reporter, had covered courts, started doing some long-form writing a little bit, but wanted to get out of Spokane. Spokane's a nice place to raise a family, not a great place to be in your 20s. And I said, Lord, not a religious person, but I said, Lord, help me get out of here. I just don't want to go anywhere hot. That's all. I'm a big man. I sweat. I just don't let me go anywhere that it's too hot. And within
a month. Or too far from Washington.
Well, I didn't care about that because I had friends there. But within a month, I had two job offers from New Times, whose two main papers were Phoenix and Miami. So I'm always I'm a big believer in the phrase, you know, if you want to hear God laugh, make a plan. You know, I've always enjoyed that. And so I was up for a job in Phoenix. The Phoenix New Times paper passed on me. The Miami New Times paper hired me. And I thought I'd be here for a year or so and then move on to something else. And that was 1991. And I've been here ever since.
And you worked 11 years at New Times.
I worked 11 years at Miami New Times. And then I wrote a book, The Day the World Came to Town, about Gander, Newfoundland. And then I spent 3 years at the Miami Herald as a columnist. I got fired from the Miami Herald. And then I went and started on TV because, let's face it, you can't let these good looks stay behind print the whole time.
I wanted to ask you about, initially, did you think you would enjoy TV? You were strictly a print guy. Probably not. But do you enjoy it now?
I didn't know what to think of TV, and I watch. And you have
radio experience too.
I also did morning drive radio and then afternoon drive radio for a year each, and I will tell you that of all the jobs, radio was the hardest.
In what way?
Just the constant time, you know, to host 3 hours of talk radio. You know, every morning or every afternoon, I did on the WINZ, which was now sports. Back then, it was
and
Progressive
Nicole
Talk.
Was your producer.
Nicole Sandler. I did 6 to 9 a.m. And then at WFTL, I did 4 to 7 p.m. Drive time both times, and it's just a lot. It's a lot of preparation. It's not just, as you well know, it's not about the 3 hours you spend on the air. It's about the 6 or 7 hours you spend before it.
A lot of people will meet me and say, what a great gig you have. You're on the hour a day for 4 days.
Right. No.
Let's just say we're speaking with CBS4 investigative reporter Jim DeFede.
It's just grueling. You know, I found radio really, I thought it was the hardest in many ways. But it was a good experience. I enjoyed it. I was also doing some magazine work. I worked for a number of national magazines, and I've always enjoyed writing. But TV is different. It's at the end of the day, what I tell folks is it's all about storytelling. Whether you're doing a 500 word column, a 5,000 word article, or just spending time in a 2.5 or 3 or 4 minute package or an hour long documentary, it's about good storytelling. That's what it has to be. It's about characters and storytelling. And with print, you have to be more descriptive. And with TV, you allow images to dictate so much that it's more, in some ways, TV is a more creative medium because it's the marriage of audio and visuals and graphics and combining them all together into
it's
something.
It's a very simple but difficult writing skill.
It's one where I get into trouble, where my producers, you know, and I work with good people, Carrie Hernandez, Liz Roldan, who's the news director, Alyssa Merlot, who's the managing editor. Where I get into trouble with them is they'll read my script sometimes and they'll say, "This reads great." And then I'll go back in the booth and I'll track it and you'll listen to it and it doesn't work. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the sentences are long. I'm writing, you know, I have to write. Writing is different for TV. Yeah. Writing is different for radio than it is for print. With print, you can have commas, you can have semicolons, you can have phrases and clauses within sentences because a reader can go back through and right. read it slower or go look back and just read it over that sentence again. When it's something that comes in through the ear, you only get one chance to hear it, one chance to understand it. It's not like they can rewind it.
The old timers used to say, tell them what you're going to say, say it, then tell them what you said.
Right.
You were named best reporter in 2017 by the New Times. And I quote, "Jim DeFede's been digging up truth longer and better than anyone else in town." You do have a knack for sniffing out the truth. But I was wondering if there was more work involved in doing that right now than there was, say, 10 years ago.
I don't know that it's hard. In some ways for me, it's probably not harder. It's probably easier only because I have a really good Rolodex. I mean, my phone, if those things exist anymore. I mean, the contacts, I mean, I have 4,000 contacts.
I've heard that word in ages.
Yeah.
But that's a print thing to say, too. You know, your strength is your Rolodex. You know, I have a couple of thousand, a few thousand names in my contacts list. So generally speaking, the trickiest part of finding something out is figuring out who has the information and who to call and ask the right question to. And when you start out, when you're new to a town, it's like 6 degrees of separation. It usually takes you 3 or 4 phone calls to figure out the one person, to figure out who it is that you actually ultimately need to call to get that information. Today, because of the amount of time I've spent here, it's 1 or 2 calls to figure that out. So in that regard, it's easier for me. But in general, I get your point, which is it's hard being a reporter in today's environment. People are distrustful of the media. People aren't as open as to sharing information. And so, yeah, it is trickier in a lot of ways.
Let's invite our listeners into the conversation. If you'd like to speak to Jim DeFede, our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Our email is radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. Alfonso in Miami writes, "I was very disappointed when you were discharged from the Miami Herald for doing what I thought to be a virtuous thing in the face of usual journalist expectation in the presence of an unusual circumstance. Thankfully for us all, local CBS affiliate WFOR4 News recognized the opportunity to bring your voice to a broader audience. Thank you for your integrity and tenacity in service to the South Florida community. By the way, do you have any insight as to why they're demolishing the dividing wall on I-95 in Miami-Dade County that to a non-engineer appeared to be sound?"
I don't, but okay. But now I'm curious, and that's really the heart of all good journalism is curiosity and somebody pointing something out and saying, why is this happening?
We've done all these programs on transportation that's never really come up.
It's never come up.
We'll have to get with Alice Bravo.
Demolishing the dividing wall on I-95 in Miami-Dade County.
Maybe we want more head-on collisions. I don't know.
He made a little bit of a reference to the unusual circumstances of why you lost your job at the Herald.
Sure.
Do you feel, though, in a way that you were kind of pushed out of print journalism at just the right time? Because investigative reporting was kind of being scrimped on a little bit because of revenue?
Let's be completely transparent and clear. I was fired after an incident in which Art Teal, Miami City Commissioner, killed himself in the lobby of the Miami Herald. I had spoken to him before his suicide. I had recorded that conversation, not in a journalistic manner, but more out of a sense of concern and panic for him. The state attorney ultimately listened to it. It was clear that I was trying to offer support to Art and not work him for a story.
He was under intense pressure.
He was under mm-hmm. he was under indictment. He was in trouble in a lot of ways. And I had known Art for many years and considered Art to be a friend. And when I talked to him that day, he was clearly in a great deal of anguish and pain. And did what I could to try to keep his mind and thoughts, you know, on one step at a time and moving forward. But that didn't come about. The Herald acted without really thinking through or understanding what took place. They never even asked me what had occurred. They just was a knee-jerk reaction. I think largely there was a new regime at the Herald at the time. Jesus Diaz was the new publisher. Jesus Diaz had made no secret that he was no fan of mine coming in.
What about Tom? Was he
Tom Fiedler. Tom Fiedler was out of town at the time. Tom was caught in a bad position. When your publisher wants to do something, you know, it would be nice if your editor backed you, but Tom didn't. And so be it. But I was fired, and within a few days, the news director at the time at CBS4, Shannon High, called me and said, "This is ridiculous. Why don't we meet for lunch?" And we met, and she said, "Why don't you come and work for Channel 4? And I said, "I've never really done TV." She said, "That's not the problem. We'll figure that part out. The TV part we'll figure out, you know, but having someone with your experience and knowledge and understanding the community and your Rolodex and all those sorts of things is invaluable. And so come and work for me."
Go on.
And I said, I thanked her, and I said, "We should find out if I'm going to go to prison first." And then I said, "Why don't we wait until the investigation into me, because it's illegal to tape record someone without their consent." And I admitted to it. I never hid it. I never tried to cover it up. Nobody else would have known that I had recorded without Arthur's consent if I didn't tell them. But I thought being honest was the right thing to do. We about 6 months later, the state attorney's office decided not to file any charges. And I went to work in January of 2006, January 2006. I went to work for Shannon.
I had you on the program on the year anniversary mm-hmm. of Art's death, and you told the story about how after that happened that night that you just drove around the community and you were trying to reach your mother back in New York so that she wouldn't hear that that awful news from anyone but you, and you were just in such shock that night.
It was surreal, doesn't quite capture it. So, yeah, by the time I was fired, it must have been around 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And I left the Herald and sort of drove around that neighborhood where the old Herald building used to be. And all I could think about was my mom wakes up, because the next day I have a column. Normally I would have a column. And my mom wakes up every morning like a good mom and plugs onto the internet and tries to figure out how to find my column. And I have an aunt who lived down here at the time, and I was just afraid that she would hear from someone else that this incident had occurred. So the first thing I did was I woke my sister up and then explained what was going on to her, and then we conference called my mother in. And what I always laugh about that conversation is I think the word fine was used probably about 400 times. "You'll be fine. I'm fine. We're fine. Everything's going to be fine. It's fine, Ma. Don't worry about it. I know, son, you're fine. Everything will be fine."
Meanwhile, the world has unraveled.
Yeah. Exactly. But I wanted to know if you had, after that, if that made you doubt yourself and...
It didn't make me doubt myself as a journalist. It made me. I wondered if my career was over. It was a strange time for journalism. I mean, if you go back, there was a lack of tolerance. Every offense that took place in journalism was a career-ending offense. There was a period where we went through a series of folks who had done plagiarism and Stephen Glass and these crimes that were journalistic crimes that were being committed resulted in just people losing their careers. And it just became in vogue to, if someone does something wrong, to fire them and banish them without any understanding of the context or gradation of the offense. And that's what scared me and it's gotten better since, but there was that feeling of is this over for me? And that's when Channel 4 came along, and to be honest, a couple other stations, other newspapers had contacted me. But to go back to your first question, in a way, I hear from people at the Herald all the time saying you got out at a good time. Mm. You know, this opened up a whole new career for you. There is still a part of me. There will always be a part of me that wishes I was still writing a column at the Miami Herald. I loved columns. Growing up
three
in Brooklyn,
a week, right?
Three a week. And when I first negotiated, it's funny. Well, when Tom Fiedler and I sat down to negotiate my arrival at the Herald, I went first, you know, Tom said, we'd like you to write one column a week. And I said, no, Tom, that's not a columnist. That's not a Metro columnist. A Metro columnist, I grew up with Jimmy Breslin. I grew up with Pete Hamill.
Dick Shapp.
You know, these guys who did it, you know. You looked for their voice every day. And I said, I think we should do five columns a week, you know. And he was like, nobody does five columns a week. I said, well, it's the Iron Man thing. You wake up in the morning and you say, well, okay, how am I going to fill those 500 words today? You know, and I go out on the street and I find something or I write about something. And he was, no, we can't do five. How about two? I said, okay, four. And then we settled on three. But yeah.
Jim, you're an experienced broadcaster. You've run us way over our break.
I'm sorry.
That's right. And we are speaking with CBS4 investigative reporter Jim DeFede. We will take our break and be right back.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Jim DeFede of CBS4. We're talking here on Topical Currents on this Tuesday afternoon. And Jim, let's turn to politics.
Your favorite subject.
First, your view on who will be the finalist in replacing Ileana Ross Leighton, District 27.
It is a cavalcade of Democrats in that race. I could not tell you right now, and let's face it, the filing deadline is still a fair way off. I mean, that's a 2018 race, so it's still almost a year away before the filing deadline comes across. I don't know who it's going to be on the Democratic side. It is a rich field with a lot of various people, a lot of different types of people, a little something for everyone. On the Republican side, you have a former school board member, Raquel Regalado, and you have County Commissioner Bruno Barrero running. You know, it's interesting that you've got all of this interest in that seat on the Democratic side, and very little interest among Democrats of challenging Carlos Curbelo, who is in just as vulnerable a seat as Ileana's seat is in terms of when you look at the demographic makeup and the D versus R. That's a Democratic. I mean, Hillary Clinton won Curbelo's seat by, I think, 17 points.
His district.
That district. So it's, you know, but of course, Carlos Curbelo has proven himself to be a very strong candidate whose ability to raise money and has shown himself moderate in some positions, not moderate in others, but, you know, has been willing to criticize Donald Trump and has sort of made a name for himself criticizing Donald Trump. So that's those two races are going to determine, in my mind, if Democrats can win back the House. If they win both of those, then the Democrats may be on that path in 2018.
Let's talk about the news today that the president has ended the DACA.
Deferred Action for Children. Right. I thought a few things struck me about that. One, in case you're not aware, the announcement was made by Jeff Sessions, the attorney general. So the president didn't even go out himself to announce it. He was trying to distance himself from it. He's placed the ball in Congress saying that he's basically going to unwind DACA and that Congress should act in the next 6 months to, I guess, keep it. But it's confusing to me, you know, if the president is behind the program, then get behind the program. You know, tell Congress to send him a clean bill that deals with these 800,000 young people who are here in this country contributing, working, doing well. They are not criminals. They are not bad people. They are the best of what you want out of young people who come to this country. You know, and so if the president really wanted to show leadership, he would tell Congress, send me a clean bill. In other words, don't try to attach stuff about the wall. Don't do stuff about cutting other legal forms of immigration. Don't do anything else. Let's just take care of these 800,000 kids. If you say that you have heart for them, then don't use them as a bargaining chip for something else. But, you know, now that it's in Congress's hands, Congress hasn't shown itself able to get anything done. And in a way, that's the sad thing, too. You can criticize Donald Trump, and Donald Trump will get a great deal of criticism from people over this decision. But if Congress cannot get their act together and protect these kids, you know, then shame on them as well.
He just, on NPR this morning, though, they played from somewhere that he was recently where he said, no, I love the Dreamers, as though he weren't
it's not surprising, but Donald Trump has been both sides of this issue. He has spoken out in support of the Dreamers. I saw, you know, a story where he talked about how after meeting with a group of Dreamers, they had changed his mind on this issue. Look, I get it. There's a constitutional argument about whether or not it's an overexertion of executive power, whether or not the executive really has the right to do this, and if this is more the province of Congress and should be done through legislation. All right. Those technical arguments, the constitutional arguments, all worthwhile. But you got 800,000 kids who came forward, came out of the shadows, registered, gave information about themselves, gave information about their families, that are now going to be put at risk and maybe deported to countries they know nothing about.
And didn't ask to come here.
And never asked to come here because they came here when they were young children.
Right. Bill Nelson, U.S. Senate.
This is going to be a great race. Bill Nelson versus Rick Scott. Rick Scott's definitely, no, don't believe anything if anyone tells you otherwise.
No Carlos Lopez.
No. Cantera. For Senate, no. It's going to be Rick Scott's running. Just a quick note about Carlos Lopez Cantera. He passed on running for Ileana's seat. My guess is, if I had to predict, that his term as lieutenant governor is up in 2018. I say that after 2018, he starts positioning himself to run for county mayor. That race will be in 2020. So I would expect Carlos Lopez Cantera, who ran countywide before as the property appraiser, will likely start setting up a fund and fundraising to run for county mayor in 2020, which will set up a race likely against Daniel Levine Cava. So you'll have a Republican versus a Democrat in a nonpartisan race. So that, put that aside. But going back to Rick Scott versus Bill Nelson, polls have them fairly even. You know, the question that it's hard to predict this far out what an election is going to be about. In 2018, November 2018, will this be a referendum on Donald Trump? Will it be a referendum on Scott's tenure as governor? Will it be whether or not Bill Nelson has done enough during his time and made himself available enough and led on enough issues? Or is he just the perennial backbencher?
And what about governor?
Governor's race is, you have to give the early nod to Adam Putnam on the Republican side as the leader, although that race is certainly not over. You'll have Richard Cochran, who is the Speaker of the House, running. Jack Latvala, who's the Senate Appropriations Committee chair, he's running. On the Democratic side, again, you've got a whole host of people. Gwen Graham, you've got a number of people running on the Democratic side. Philip Levine will likely run. And so we'll have to wait and sort of see that as well. It's going to be one thing I know for sure is it's going to be a good year for TV stations and for radio stations. Not this one because you're public, but for radio public, for private radio and TV stations, a lot of advertising going to come in down the way.
Well,
CBS 4 investigative reporter Jim DeFede. His program Facing South Florida airs Sunday mornings at 8:30. During football season, I guess that's about now, right?
Right now, okay. Right now we're at 8:30,
and rest of the year it's 11:30 a.m. And his documentary, "The Everglades: Where Politics, Money, and Race Collide," can be seen at cbsmiami.com/Everglades.
There you go.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
Joe, and thank you, really. Thank you for everything you've done for this community. I mean that sincerely.
Those are very heartfelt words for you to say. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And we appreciate you for tuning in this hour. If you didn't catch the whole program or want to link to others, we have free audio links at the WLRN.org website. Today's program produced by Polly Landis. Technical direction from online content producer Jason Zabka. Richard Ives is lead producer. And tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Bonnie and I return Thursday with Sun Sentinel consumer columnist Doreen Christensen and, of course, chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gansenheimer. She'll have word about a local veggie restaurant with mock buffalo wings and chicken tacos. How's that?
What about bacon?
Didn't see bacon on it. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.